Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So a Californian, 26-year-old male, was arrested last night in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Dressed in black, had a suitcase, backpack, a Glock 17 with two magazines. Do you want to ban those? No. And ammunition, pepper spray, a tactical knife, hammer, screwdriver, crowbar, zip ties, and duct tape. He was upset over the leaked draft of an opinion that would overturn Roe v. Wade, he apparently told police, and he came to Chevy Chase, Maryland to kill Justice Kavanaugh, thinking it would give his life purpose. He is now in custody, has been charged with attempted murder.
But why do you think he felt so empowered that he could just go to a Supreme Court justice's house to wreak havoc and to try to murder somebody? It's because of all those riots that happened. Not riots, protests, excuse me, that happened outside of his house and Amy Coney Barrett's and Robert's house.
Well, the words of Chuck Schumer over the last year or so certainly ring relevant.
If protests are peaceful, yes. My house is, there's protests 3-4 times a week outside my house. That's the American way to peacefully protest is okay. Mm-hmm. And I've been, that's my wife.
Uh-huh. Oh, really? Three to four times a week?
That was his defense of organizations like Ruth Sent Us, doxing Supreme Court justices, and otherwise what was going on outside the homes of Supreme Court justices, which arguably, and a former Attorney General Barr made the argument, as did others, was actually not lawful protests given federal statute. But Chuck Schumer papered over that because before he took that position, he was taking this one in March of 2020 at a pro-abortion rally.
And they're taking away fundamental rights. I want to tell you, Gorsuch, I want to tell you, Kavanaugh, you have released the whirlwind and you will pay the price. You won't know what hit you if you go forward with these awful decisions.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. Does Chuck Schumer bear any culpability for this attempt on Kavanaugh's life? Wyoming Senator John Barrasso, chairman of the Senate Republican Conference, was on Fox yesterday suggesting that, yeah, he does.
And I believe Chuck Schumer bears some responsibility because he has contributed to this atmosphere of directly attacking members by name of the Supreme Court. Remember, talking about abortion, Chuck Schumer went to the steps of the Supreme Court and he called out Kavanaugh by name.
What did he say? You have unleashed the whirlwind?
He said, I'm telling you, Kavanaugh, you will pay the price. You will not know what hit you.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, I don't... I'm loath to play this game that the left likes to play of somebody's words or the causal link to somebody else's actions. But I do agree with Barrasso, not necessarily that Schumer bears culpability, but more to the point, it's an opportunity to give lie to this left's on-again, off-again posture about civility in our politics and about the defending peaceful protesters and their distinguishing between the peaceful and the mostly peaceful, because they don't. They don't. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line.
And look, he had U.S. Marshals outside of his house. Anyway, there was two of them that spotted him getting out of the car. But the guy actually called 911 on himself. That's how crazy he was. And then they went and got him and found all this, you know, zip ties and all the items that you mentioned.
I guess we're going to have to raise the age that you're able to buy a Glock 17 to 27 because he was 26. Right. Charles Blow, I mean, because this in part implicates the debate over guns that's going. And I would say that the left needs these things to happen. They need these things to happen. I'm talking about this attempt on Kavanaugh's life. I'm talking about mass shootings. Charles Blow, who's a New York Times columnist, writing recently, I find that the gun safety debate lacks candor. People believe it's savvier to tell only part of the truth, to soft pedal the sell in an effort to get something, anything done, but lying will always lead to a trap. The truth that no one wants to tell, that the one that opponents of gun safety laws understand and the reason so many of them resist new laws, is that no one law or single package of laws will be enough to solve America's gun violence problems. The solution will have to be a nonstop parade of laws with new ones passed as they are deemed necessary ad infinitum, in the same way that Republicans have been promoting gun proliferation and loosening gun laws for decades. Gun safety advocates will have to do the opposite also for decades. And so if gun violence went away, what would the predicate for the left be to offer their nonstop, his words, nonstop parade of laws? Just like the left has a bottomless appetite, an insatiable appetite for racism, so they will create it where it doesn't exist. So they have a insatiable need for violence because it's the predicate for them to intervene and restrict the individual's rights.
And they'll stop at nothing. I mean, having that fourth grader yesterday who survived Uvalde, she put her friend's blood all over her and played dead. Having her testify, she just went through the most traumatic thing in her life. That people will never go through something horrific as that. And I know it was a pre-taped message or pre-taped interview, but still, it just made me sick. Leave her alone. We know her dad testifying was enough, and her dad is actually more powerful than her. But we don't need to hear it all over again. And if this is something that, you know, they're celebrating.
There's a door between our classrooms, and he went through there and shot my teacher and told my teacher goodnight and shot her in the head. And then he shot some of my classmates and the whiteboard. When I went to the backs, he shot my friend that was next to me. And I thought he was going to come back to the room. So I grabbed the blood and I put it all over me.
They're doing this because they want to let people know Republicans are bad for not passing any type of gun reform. Look at these people that are hurting. And I know they're hurting, and I know it's awful, but I feel like they're using a lot of people soon after a tragedy to try and get their point across.
They need the violence, the left. Charles Blow, Jonathan Capehart in the Washington Post, Amazon Post. Black Americans may need to flee the country due to crazy white people. Why black people are afraid of crazy white people? Black people don't fear typical white people, but rather crazy ones. Things felt so dicey during the Trump years, I half joke that my husband and I might have to reenact the scene from The Sound of Music and flee the country. Now, an alarming report from the Southern Poverty Law Center shows that my Operation Von Trapp might need to go live. The ranks of crazy white people appear to be growing, and the rest of us don't know what to do about it. So there's your combo platter. There's your racism, white supremacy around every corner, in addition to associated violence, thus the need for critical race theory, for reparations, for the whole litany of racial grievances to be addressed, in addition to law-abiding gun owners stripped as much as possible in this moment of their individual right to self-protection. They need it. And where they can't find it, they will invent it, Jussie Smollett style.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
I want to tell you something. I really liked your tweet on Mayor Lightfoot's new campaign pin.
Oh, yeah. I saw that. Riding with Lori.
Riding with Lori. She's in a, you know, old, like, classic convertible.
Right.
With the exhaust, you know, pumping out the back for comedic effect or whatever, whatever. I'm sure the
exhaust.
Green community is going to be upset with that.
She must be not driving one of those coal-powered cars that are so popular.
But your tweet was, all that's missing is the carjacking.
Yeah.
Oh, brilliant.
Well.
Brilliant.
You know, just like to make sure things are accurate, accurate reflection of the reality. Last night, this guy who used to co-host The Man Show, he's got a late night program now, apparently. And I'll tell you, his narrating of girls jumping on trampolines was the perfect training for that mimbo to interview the sundowning one that appeared on his show last night. That would be the president of the United States, Joe Biden. Serious discussion. This is Biden's first one-on-one interview with a reporter.
No, he's
in quotation marks.
No.
In 4 months. Is that right? I think so.
Oh.
Looking for a friendly audience, and he found one, one that was masked up. And it was.
No, the audience was masked up.
Oh, yeah. Jill was there, his granddaughter, something. He comes out from behind the curtain, he takes his mask off. It's all very performative. I mean, it's quite a show they put on, Kimmel and the big guy. And, of course, the topic was guns and abortion and, you know, how Republicans hate America, so on and so forth. But the big guy's comments were instructive. Guns, abortion, and January 6th. That is what the Democrat Socialists are going to try to make November about, because they can't make it about any of the quality of life issues that impact you, given the big guy's record on the topic.
Wait,
on those
what
topics.
About crime and inflation and gas prices and the housing market?
That was touched upon a bit, but they've got scapegoats for all of those matters that aren't going so well. First on guns and doing something. You know what the problem is?
Republicans.
Well, of course.
Well, I think a lot of us intimidation by the NRA. And look, this is not your father's Republican Party. This is a MAGA party. It's a very different Republican Party. And so you find people who are worried, I believe, that if they vote for rational gun policy, they're going to be primaried and they're going to lose in a hard right Republican primary.
Right. It's the NRA. It's the gun lobby. It's not millions of individual law-abiding gun owners.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA. Then a quick comment. Did anybody watch it last night?
And just a reminder, too, because the big guy prattled on about the assault weapon ban sunsetting like he is, but that was back in 2005. And under W, just a reminder, if it was so important, if it was such a game changer, then the natural follow-up question that was not asked by a dolt like Kimmel when you and President Obama and Democrats had all three branches of government, and the important two, when you were elected in 2009, you had 2 years. Why wasn't that a first order of business to reinstitute it? Why? So important. Such a watershed moment in public safety history in America. Because it wasn't. And because it's not politically sellable. And it has nothing to do with the boogeymen that the big guy likes to bloviate about. Kimmel then jumped in to me too, the big guy, you know, do his best sucking up. You know, it's funny. I remember when to have a television show.
Yeah.
Used to have sort of have some discernible talent. Some identifiable chops, whether comedic or intellectual. And I've just noticed that it's, well, it's the opposite. It's the more of a just raving moron that you are, the more likely it is you're going to be making $20 million hosting some show on TV.
I can't watch Jimmy Fallon. I can't watch any of those shows.
Kimmel and the big guy kicking around guns a bit more.
It seems like maybe the party has moved hard right, but I don't know that the people have moved
they
hard
haven't.
Right. People overwhelmingly believe we should have serious background checks. They overwhelmingly
look, Jimmy, you may remember the last time we did something serious about guns was when I passed the assault weapons ban. I was the guy that sponsored that, got it passed, limiting the number of bullets that could be in a magazine, whole background checks, a whole range of things. And we passed, and violent crime and gun crime dropped off. But I could only get it passed for 10 years. It had to be reauthorized. And when the first Bush administration came along, they didn't reauthorize it. We didn't have the votes. And so what happened was, all of a sudden, it came back. You could own assault weapons again. And guess what? Crime went up significantly, 3 times. I mean, so there is a direct correlation between the kinds of weapons that can be had.
There isn't. It's untrue. It's unable to be substantiated because it's completely untrue. Doesn't mean he won't continue saying it. We addressed this every time he said it over the last week or 2 weeks since Buffalo. But something else about that and about what Kimmel said too. Serious background checks. Anybody stop and like challenge these characterizations that are made?
What's the difference between there are background checks in place. We know we're gun owners. And what is it, a serious background check and a background check? Are they really serious now? To expand it from 3 days to 10. What good is that going to do?
I don't know.
Really?
What was there a background check that was going to stop any of the recent mass shooters?
No, because they had no mental health documentations on their records for the 18-year-old Buffalo Devil and the one at Uvalde.
And so we have
people knew they were crazy, but there's nothing documented.
And so we have the same. It has nothing to do with addressing what has transpired and recently and over the course of many decades in America with these incidents of mass violence. Nothing to do with any of that. It's just about my feelings and doing something. Nothing to do with what the House passed yesterday. It has nothing to do with the mass shootings or that have happened recently. Nothing at all. Completely irrelevant. But that's okay. They have their moral indignation.
Shouldn't we demand that every senator in the United States sit with those families?
Oh.
Is Jimmy Kimmel crying?
Quivering voice. Because Biden, the big guy, has met with the victims' families. Okay. You want to demand that every senator sit with the victims' families? I agree. That's fine. They should. Go ahead. And if we're going to be a representative republic that is led by adults, we'll have to tell families that I'm terribly sorry for what happened to your loved one. But what is being proposed by the big guy and his ilk has nothing to do with improving safety, has nothing to do with preventing the next incident, like the one that took the life of your loved one. And so that's why I'm not supporting it. Because this isn't about making me feel good or shining you on, which is what the left likes to do. Shine people on and give them a false sense of security, a false sense of safety. I'm not going to do that. So if you want to believe they're right, well, you're welcome to believe that. I disagree. Because someone suffered a loss doesn't mean they have the policy answer. So you can at one time empathize and commiserate with a person who has suffered a terrible tragedy in their family, and at the same time say, but this is not the sensible response to what happened in Buffalo, in Uvalde, every weekend in Chicago, in Philadelphia, Chattanooga, Phoenix over the weekend. This is not the proper response.
But so, they feel like they need to do something.
Yeah, well, okay. And this is where adults have to say, and so we don't just do something and we explain. You do the right thing. And so Jimmy Kimmel's quivering call for senators to meet with the families. Yeah? Okay. Happy to. What else do you have? Nothing else. All he has is emotion. But this is where Biden reveals
who he is or the plan.
Well, reveals what this is about.
You got to make sure that this becomes a voting issue. It's got to be one of those issues where you decide your position on the issue, senator or candidate for House or Senate, on what we're going to do on us with assault weapons and how have to have, able to have 300 rounds in a magazine. And I mean, what you say on those things is going to determine how I'm going to vote for you. It should be one of those issues.
So that's one. And here's two. Kimmel being the P-hat pro-abort feminist narrator of Girls on Trampolines that he is, very concerned about the legalization of killing children, and he offered this.
I think if the court overrules Roe v. Wade and does what is draft,
what we fear they will.
Well, if that occurs, I think we have to legislate it. We have to make sure we pass legislation making it a law that is the federal government says this is how it works.
Yet another situation where most of the country is on the same page. Something like 64% of Americans do not want to see Roe v. Wade overturned.
And it's just going to be the beginning, by the way. You know, there used to be a case called Connecticut versus Griswold.
I'm very familiar with it.
Well, but all kidding aside.
Is that from the National Lampoon Vacation movie?
It is. But Connecticut versus Griswold said that you could not use contraception in the privacy of your own bedroom because in the Constitution there was no right to privacy. And so they could outlaw, and if you used contraception, it was against the law. You couldn't purchase contraception. And, you know, there's a whole range of things that are at stake here when we talk about eliminating Roe v. Wade and all the flows.
Same-sex marriage.
I mean, it's just ridiculous,
right,
in my view.
Everything's going to go. By the way, he had the holding in Griswold reversed, but that's okay. He's the big guy.
There's some Democrats out there that actually think that they're going to go around and yank women's IUDs out of them.
Of course.
That's how crazy.
Right. And there's no need to pay attention to the comments of Alito and other conservative justices on the Griswold decision. No need to pay any attention to that because why be honest? But here's the point of that. What do you got to do? What do you got to do if you're a hysteric like Jimmy Kimmel and you're worried about Dobbs overturning the Dobbs holding, overturning Roe?
If they overrule Roe v. Wade and the state, California won't do it, but other states say if they overrule Roe v. Wade and the state, California won't do it, but other states say that you cannot do the following, and it's a law, you can't cross the border, you can't, all the things that some states have. And you got to make sure that you vote. You got to vote and let people know exactly what the devil you think.
Is there a law in some state that doesn't allow you to cross the border of the state you're in to another state?
But
a law that won't allow you to cross the border.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter. But you get the overriding point here. Don't make November about anything that I've done.
Yeah.
Don't make it about crime. Don't make it about your pocketbook issues or your safety. Make it about guns and abortion. And the other thing, too, I mean, Jimmy Kimmel, I mean, sophist is too generous a word for him. He's just a doofus. The cherry picked poll numbers about where the majority is to try to cower people who disagree with him into believing there's some sort of insular minority. This is a classic Alinsky tactic, although he would have no idea that is the case. He's just
that uninformed voter.
He's just doing what he sees from D.C. politicians.
Yeah, but uninformed Americans hear that and are like, oh, he's right. They don't question it. They don't take time to do that.
And, you know, the simple response is your numbers are wrong and they're more nuanced than you're communicating. However, let's say they're true. Do we live in a representative republic or a direct democracy? If it's just about wherever a majority is on a particular issue at a given moment in time, then why don't we, instead of packing the court, why don't we just disband the court? Why don't we disband Congress? We don't even need a president. We just have a national plebiscite on every issue that comes up, and wherever 50% plus one is, the military enforces it. That's the kind of thinking you get not only from late night talk show hosts of this generation, but also from the left as well, that appeal to polling as some sort of justification for their argument. You have to win arguments based on the merits, the substance of them, because, you know, if it was based on popularity, then we would be a long way still from marriage redefinition. Remember how before the Obergefell decision, marriage redefinition went 0 for 33 at the state level in statewide referenda? And then Obergefell came in and people got used to it, and now opinion has changed. There where a majority believes it. But it wouldn't have happened in 2013, I'll tell you that. So there's the rule of law in a representative republic. And then there's the silliness you get from, unfortunately, the president of the United States as he is being set up by some clown with a late night talk show. Marty in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Dan, your last sentence is exactly what I said. A clown by a late night talks on a late night talk show. A clown talking to a clown. You're right. I love that. Well, it's 64%, you know, of the country. And then he talks about some ruling. And Jimmy Kimmel, I'm very familiar with that. This is what's wrong. People, again, I've talked about this before. My wife's family will eat this stuff up. All of a sudden, Jimmy Kimmel's a genius to these people. I mean, it's just this is the problem. And then when the voice quivers, that's always a good one. It's the only acting that Jimmy Kimmel does because he's terrible at everything else. And it probably took him 3 years of drama school to do that. So
thanks for the call, Marty. Appreciate it. You know, all those people who said, you know, during the Trump administration, Mike Judge's idiocracy come to life. No. What you saw last night, if you watched it, or what you will see if you watch it, between Kimmel and Biden, that is idiocracy come to life.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, the January 6th committee.
Prime time.
Does their primetime show. I wonder, like, will Claire Danes sit in for Liz Cheney? You know?
Who's going to sit in for Adam Kinzinger? Michael Fox? Michael J. Fox? We're going to start this game again. Let's go! 312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro. Answer line 646-36. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
I could see Mandy Patinkin for Jamie Raskin. Okay. I mean, I think they should have their Hollywood stunt doubles, these members of Congress, since this is going to be, you know, their end of year production.
Well, and the reason why, because they're going to come out. So they have obtained the Proud Boys documentarians video, and that's exclusive new video that you're going to see tonight. Also, testimonials from Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner. Their depositions, their interviews are going to be broadcasted.
Not testimonials.
Testimony, excuse me.
Well, here's the thing about this production that's being put on.
All political.
James Goldston, the former president of ABC News, and a master documentary storyteller who ran Good Morning America and Nightline, joined the committee as an unannounced advisor. This is Axios reporting it. Goldstein is producing this 7 p.m. hearing as if it were an investigative special. Where's Jerry Rivers when you need him?
This is wrong.
So as Michael Goodwin wrote in the New York Post, perhaps the label on tonight's offering should be based on a true story.
Okay.
Like a Lifetime, drama or soap opera.
They're also going to be featuring Capitol Police Officer Caroline Edwards, who was maced in the face during January 6th.
What is it for you that sticks in your head?
The screaming. When somebody shows me footage of the 6th, I have to have them turn off the sound. Because that sound, that screaming, that just constant, I can't hear it. It takes me back to a very bad place.
She's going to be one of the people who testify.
Okay. The point is, it's a Hollywood production.
Right.
And one of those fungible CNN hosts, John Berman, acknowledged he once worked under Goldston at ABC News, called him a terrific television producer. CNN anchor Laura Jarrett, daughter of Valerie Jarrett, said the committee needs a media pro's touch. It shows you they want to make this compelling. They know that a certain segment of the American public has a tin ear to this, sadly, and shouldn't, but has seen that video of them storming the Capitol so many times it may not have the same impact. And so I think they brought in essentially an expert, a showrunner, to try to package it in a way that breaks through. Oh, I thought this was a fact-finding mission by serious people who are elected members of Congress, I would say if it was up to them, a high school production, but obviously you're bringing in the big guns.
You're bringing in the big guns. They know what they're doing. It's going to be sleek. It's going to be fast. They're going to capture the young people's audience with only 3 seconds here, a second here, 5 seconds there. This is bull jive, and thank God Fox News is the only cable station that is not, or only it's TV station that's not going to be covering it. They're going to keep their main lineup in place.
Yeah, Hillary Clinton commented on that, saying Fox News won't air the January 6th hearings because they prefer their sedition made fresh on site. Boy.
Anybody going to be watching this? I'm
stones
watching it
on
for
that
work.
Woman. The basis of this is a fact-finding mission to preserve our democracy so it never happens again. We almost lost our democracy. We need to preserve our democracy. We need to prevent future insurrections. That's the point of this fact-finding mission, right?
The point is U.S. Capitol Police didn't call the National Guard because they just wanted this to happen. They needed it to happen. They knew it was coming. Come on, everybody knows that, and they didn't do anything to call in reinforcement.
So the point of the hearing, this isn't me saying, it's the New York Times.
Yes.
January 6th hearings give Democrats a chance to recast midterm message. Quote, with their control of Congress hanging in the balance, Democrats plan to use made-for-television moments and a carefully choreographed rollout of revelations over the course of 6 hearings to persuade, between now and September, to persuade voters that the coming midterm elections are a chance to hold Republicans accountable for it. So there's the actual raison d'etre for the committee the last year and a half, and then this 6-week limited series based on a true story that we have.
And is the committee even legit? I mean, what Republicans do they have on the committee? They selected the never-Trumper congressman, Cheney, and Adam Kinzinger, who we still haven't figured out who's going to play the role of Adam Kinzinger.
Sometimes you go outside of the political and policy circle to get just some common sense, man-on-the-street perspective. Jack Del Rio offered such. Jack Del Rio is the defensive coordinator for the Washington football team. I guess they're called the Commanders now.
Commanders, yes.
Ron Rivera, former Bear, he's the coach, head coach. Here's what Jack Del Rio had to say about the show.
I just asked a simple question, really. Let's get right down to it. What did I ask? A simple question. Why are we not looking into those things? If we're going to talk about it, why are we not looking into those things? Because it's kind of hard for me to say. I can realistically look at it. I see the images on TV. People's livelihoods are being destroyed. Businesses are being burned down. No problem. And then we have a dust up at the Capitol. Well, there's nothing burned down. And we're not going to talk about, we're going to make that a major deal. I just think it kind of two standards. And if we apply the same standard and we're going to be reasonable with each other, let's have a discussion. That's all it was. Let's have a discussion. We're Americans. Let's talk it through. I'm for us, you know, having a great opportunity to have a fulfilled life. Like I said, every which way I can, when I'm here, it's about love and respect. I love my guys. I respect my guys. But I also love the fact that I'm an American, and that means I'm free to express myself, and I'm not afraid to do that.
Yeah, good for you. So it's interesting the point he raises. By the way, he later, you know, was probably semi-compelled to apologize for characterizing 1-6 as a dust-up, saying that was, since there were officers injured, that was irresponsible and negligent to call it a dust-up. But his overriding comparison in terms of the interest in getting to the bottom of attacks on institutions of violence, whether it's at the Capitol or on the streets of America's cities, there's interest at the Capitol and not much interest from Soros-funded non-prosecution prosecutors and big blue city and mayors and blue state governors when it comes to the rioting that took place in the summer of 2020. Certainly right about that. In addition to the incitement accusation in the direction of one former president, Trump incited what happened on January 6th. But these same people will say that Schumer in no way incited this threat on Brett Kavanaugh's life that was prevented yesterday. You know, these just shifting. I mean, so to Del Rio's larger point, which we see all the time, is the shifting standards. You know, one standard applies to my opponent. Another standard applies to me. Depending on the circumstances, we can flip those standards around.
This is the biggest political stunt we've seen in our lifetime. A primetime ABC, NBC, CBS are covering it, too. I'm with Congressman Jim Jordan on this one.
Of course they are.
This is completely choreographed presentation, completely partisan. The good news is the American people have figured all that out.
Of course they are. Of course they're covering it. I mean, that they're the comm shop for the Democrat Socialist Party. You just heard the New York Times reporting on this, saying this is an opportunity to recast the midterms. Yes. So it's all hands on deck.
Do you know that when President Biden delivered the commencement address at University of Delaware, he said in his speech about the January 6th that two officers died that day? Officer Sitnik, as we all know now, did not have his, being at work on January 6th had nothing to do with his death. He had a stroke and a brain aneurysm. And then there was no other officer that was killed that day.
There's also, and we'll talk to her a little bit later in the program, Julie Kelly has a good piece at American Greatness about what the hearings will not cover. Some questions that could have been asked, some issues that could have been raised if the Democrat Socialists wanted to have a truly bipartisan commission and impose no limitations on the fact finding and then offer whatever the facts are in a transparent, forthright manner. But they didn't want to do that. They rejected the nominees that Kevin McCarthy leveled up for the commission so they could have two quislings named Kinzinger and Cheney and present this as some sort of Republican representation,
which it's not,
on the commission. By the way,
don't be fooled.
According to recent polling, Liz Cheney is in heap big trouble in her primary election in Wyoming.
She's not going to win.
She's down by, I mean, one poll had her down to the state senator that Trump's backing by like 30 points. So we'll see. But Julie Kelly, some things that have not been addressed, except by some in the conservative media. Will the committee release 14,000 hours of surveillance video to show what happened inside and outside the Capitol building on January 6th? Biden's Justice Department quickly designated the footage as, quote unquote, highly sensitive government material that remains under strict protective orders in court proceedings. Yeah, why just allow the public to see cherry-picked snippets from the surveillance? Why not allow anybody who wants to watch as much of it as they want to watch it and have, you know, you see some people committing acts of violence, as certainly did happen. And we might see some things that those with a clear political agenda don't want us to see that provide important context. I don't know. We can't see it. What about the security video from January 5th? Will the committee explain why Capitol Police erased almost all the surveillance video from the day before the protest? Hmm. Where are the internal investigative reports on police misconduct on January 6th? Will the committee disclose how many undercover FBI agents or informants were used in any way involved with January 6th? We can't get an answer from Merrick Garland or Christopher Wray when they testify before Congress. But I thought this was a fact-finding mission. I thought this was in the interest of transparency and preserving our democracy. Well, if half the country or more doesn't think your work product is legitimate, doesn't think the institution, frankly, is legitimate because of star chamber proceedings like the 1-6 Commission, then how exactly do you think you're preserving our democracy?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Mm. There's more here, too, Kelly raises. You know, the pipe bomber that was supposedly on site?
Yeah, that left a pipe bomb at the DNC headquarters and the RNC.
Yeah.
Was he ever caught?
Despite the FBI's use of extensive tools, including geofence warrants, to track down Capitol protesters, the department still has not been able to identify the pipe bomber. Further, the department appears to have lost interest in the crime, an inexplicable move since the Justice Department finally admitted in court filings last year that Kamala Harris was not inside the DNC. Was inside the DNC building, not the Capitol building, as the government claimed in court documents for over a year when Capitol Police located the explosive. So surely the committee has a heightened interest in finding the man who could have killed a sitting U.S. senator and incoming vice president just hours before Congress certified her election. So where's the final FBI report on the incident? It's a good question.
Or was that staged? I don't trust anybody anymore.
What about Ray Epps? We've talked about the video that has made its way around about Ray Epps, this individual who is on video instigating incursions inside the Capitol, who's identified and who appears to be, he was originally on the FBI's most wanted list. Then maybe he's an FBI asset, but he's never been charged with anything. And he has committee members rushed to his defense. Kinzinger said on Twitter, committee investigators had interviewed Epps and a transcript would be released. It hasn't been released. That was 5 months ago. So a lot of questions is the point. A lot of questions. And will we get answers to any of those questions tonight? No. Will they even be asked? No, not by anybody on that committee and that commission, not by anybody producing or that are bit players in this James Goldston produced made for TV special, former president of ABC News.
I mean, what you guys are going to see tonight is going to be of Hollywood level quality.
So good luck if you think that this sort of stilted investigation, in quotation marks, and a theatrical interpretation of it is going to reframe the midterms for you, as the New York Times has disclosed the Democrat Socialists hope it will do.
And I love how the committee members, they did this, you know, in the month of June because, you know, May sweeps are over. They wouldn't dare do it during May sweeps. But now, you know, they've got game shows on and reruns, so why not? They got all the networks to go along with this, all the cable stations, except for Fox.
Here's
you have David Muir, Lester Holt anchoring
yeah,
prime
of course.
Time from 8
of course.
7 to 10.
That's the least surprising thing about any of it.
I don't know how they got them all to do it.
What do you mean? Which part of the comm shop of the Democrat Socialist Party do you not understand?
This is just unprecedented.
No, it's not unprecedented. No, it's not
do a late night, a prime time here, come well, hearing that they've been doing for 2 years during the day.
The comm shop does for the party what the comm shop does for the party. You know, let's just dispense with the contrived, surprise and moral indignation. This is who they are. And here's the more important point. When you destroy the legitimacy of these institutions, then you destroy the legitimacy of these institutions. I'm sorry to offer that from the Department of Redundancy Department, but you undermine the legitimacy and then you want us to come to the table with an open mind and you want us to believe that you're acting in good faith, despite everything that's been done to this point being examples of bad faith.
This is the Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Sports and politics and sports and politics and sports and politics and intersection. Arrogance and ignorance, arrogance, ignorance, and arrogance and ignorance.
Intersection.
Woo! Yeah. Okay, good night.
It's like I'm out at the ballpark. I'm eating peanuts.
What's wrong with you? Dan's,
I'm doing
Dan's
Steve
got
Dahl
a
routine.
Dan's,
I'm eating food on air.
Dan's got a mouthful of nuts right now. Mm. You could be like Kev Head. I worked with him one time, and he was smacking gum. I'm like, excuse me, do you realize you're chewing gum while you're talking? So I made him spit it out.
So I mentioned this at the end of the show yesterday. Want to talk about it today, so we're going to.
Yeah, we mentioned it, yes.
And
I need help here.
The PGA and the competition from the Saudi-backed LIV Tour.
Which is now, coming to Sugar Grove in late September.
Yeah, Rich Harvest is one of the locations for one of their events. Anyway, you know, we are critical of the NBA for being wholly owned subsidiaries, the NBA teams, of the Chinese. And, you know, you're not allowed to speak out against the Chinese. Even the moral voice of the NBA, Steve Kerr, won't talk about Chinese communist atrocities, you know, like concentration camps. And so do we not have to hold the Phil Mickelsons and the Dustin Johnsons and the Patrick Reeds and the Bryson DeChambeaus of the world to account for siding with the Saudis? Remember, you know, especially for those on the left, the big guy, when he was campaigning for the president of the United States back in 2019, said he was going to make Saudi Arabia a pariah state for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. And here we are in 2022, and what's the big guy doing? Genuflecting before the Saudi family and MBS.
Begging for more oil. He's on his knees.
Exactly.
Yeah, so he can go over there, and he can do what he wants, but others can't.
But, of course, the Saudis, Saudi Arabia is a repressive state. It's a Islamist state.
It's where the 9/11 hijackers came from.
I wouldn't exactly say that women are on equal footing under the law over there.
No, no. They just were allowed to drive.
So what is the comment on comments like those from Phil Mickelson? So announced that the Saudi-backed LIV tour, that Greg Norman, who's the front man for the tour, who's just a... Greg Norman, terrible. And not just because he ruined my chance to caddy in the Western Open, but including that.
Still stings, huh?
They rolled out Phil Mickelson reportedly being paid $200 million. And the difference between the PGA Tour and the LIV is these high-profile pros, they're getting guaranteed money. It's not like you got to go out and win it.
No, they offered Tiger Woods $1 billion. And
reportedly.
He said no.
Here's Mickelson talking about his decision and his sort of on again, off again criticism of human rights abuses in Saudi Arabia.
earlier, I don't condone human rights violations. I don't know how I can be any more clear. I understand your question. But again, I love this game of golf. I've seen the good that it's done. And I see the opportunity for LIV Golf to do a lot of good for the game throughout the world. And I'm excited to be about a part of this opportunity.
And he went on to offer an apology of sorts for some of the comments made previously that had him out of the Masters and out of the PGA.
Phil, you also spoke about leverage. You used the word leverage. And here you are sitting representing the very people you were using to leverage. How do you explain that?
I've really enjoyed my time on the PGA Tour. I've had some incredible experiences, some great memories, and I have a lot of strong opinions on things that should and could be a lot better. One of the mistakes I've made is voicing those publicly. So I will really make an effort to keep those conversations behind closed doors going forward. I think that's the way to be the most efficient and get the most out of it.
He's pressed on that a little bit more.
Clarify, you've apologized again just now. Can you just clarify what you're apologizing for? Is it you're sorry for speaking the truth about the Saudis? Or are you sorry for the shameless hypocrisy of taking their money anyway?
I understand that many people have very strong opinions and may disagree with my decision. And I can empathize with that. But at this time, this is an opportunity that gives me a chance to have the most balance in my life going forward, and I think this is going to do a lot of good for the game.
And I need money. And
wow. Right. $200 million for Phil, $125 for DJ, $100 for DeChambeau. Those are the reported numbers. Guaranteed money. But they're in the pockets of the Saudis. How do you react to some of golf's greats selling out the PGA Tour? This is one characterization. Selling out the PGA Tour for the LIV Tour, the Saudi-backed LIV Tour. Are they the modern-day Kurt Floods of golf? Is that what we have here, which have some sort of vindicated? Now, the interesting thing is Phil also said, you know, he looks forward to playing in the majors, too. See, it's interesting. The resignation from the PGA Tour.
Great, help me out here.
Dustin Johnson did. Kevin Na did. And the belief is, so there's different governing bodies. So the PGA Tour is a governing body. Uh-huh. The RNA is a governing body. The Masters is its own governing body. So the question is, what will the other governing bodies do if the PGA Tour says you're either on the tour or you're off the tour? So will they follow suit and prohibit the LIV Tour players from playing in the Masters, the British Open?
Right, that's the thing.
Or
because once you win the Masters, you're always welcome back to the Masters.
Well, that's right. Then the other thing too is the exemptions that some of these players that are going to the LIV Tour already have for the majors and how you deal with those. So there's some questions here, but in terms of the formatics, but the larger question, do you find this despicable, or, hey, you just go to the highest bidder and that's what athletes do and it's no big deal? But now remember, if it's no big deal for Phil and DJ and Bryson to sell out to the Saudis, is it still a big deal for LeBron and the NBA to sell out to the Chi-Coms?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. Is it un-American? Is it unpatriotic that they're leaving the PGA and going to the Saudis, to the LIV? What do you think about that? Because that was one complaint I saw on social media, that it's un-American for them to turn their backs on the PGA and help the Saudis.
Ewan Murray writing in The Guardian, Dustin Johnson's act of greed stands out in Saudi Arabia's vulgar rebranding game. This cannot legitimately be labeled in any other terms. There is no commercial sense whatsoever in dishing out wild sums to those who are either marking time until their senior tour, would not turn heads in any high street in the UK, or in Johnson's case, Dustin Johnson's case, whose PGA Tour earnings from the game total around $72 million, having torched their reputation by such a grotesque display of greed. Is that what this is? Grotesque display of greed. Golfers are willing pawns in Saudi's rebranding game, which is a great pity for the sport's reputation. There will be intrigue around what LIV can deliver. That it is staging a tournament at all confounds many skeptics. There are no world ranking points available, unhelpful ticket prices, no mainstream television outlet to offer. Competitions 54 holes and has a pro-am event. In short, not exactly marching toward the territory of sporting revolution. For every Johnson, Graham McDowell, Lee Westwood, or Sergio Garcia, there are other players he just names. It's immaterial. That the Austrian Matt Jones, who has more than $17 million in earnings, explained his involvement thus. A lot to do with my family, being able to provide for them. Purely a business decision for me. I'm very happy with the decision I made. And here's the rub. The world doesn't know or care anywhere near enough about Matt Jones to criticize the 42-year-old for this. Last place in the 48-man field is worth $120,000. A team element carries a $5 million prize fund. This is the LIV format. There's no prize money for finishing last in a PGA Tour event, by contrast, and the next tournament on the calendar, the Canadian Open, offers $1.5 million to the winner. So you just get a sense of the sort of money that's being thrown at this by the Saudis. Players taking Saudi money is a bad look for golf, he writes. And DeChambeau, Bryson DeChambeau said, I don't think that at this point in time I'm in a place in my career where I can risk things like that, injuries and so forth. I'm loyal to my family that I've created around me with sponsors and everything. And the golf world is probably going to change in some capacity. I don't know how that is. It's not my job to do so. I just keep going to keep playing professional golf, enjoy it wherever it takes me, play with the best players in the world. DeChambeau's sentiment illustrates what the LIV is up against. Plus the widespread sense there's very little competitive validity in its offering. This is sport just in too vulgar a form that we should be expected to know it. Of course, DeChambeau then ultimately folded in with the LIV based on the money that was offered. What about that? I mean, you know, and again, this is, you may not be an NBA fan, but you still understand its importance in American culture. You may not be a PGA fan, but you still understand its importance in American culture. Mike and Galena, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. I'm just absolutely, I'm a PGA golf professional, and I just can't believe that Phil Mickelson and Greg Norman, who's, by the way, not even really, I think, a citizen of the United States, certainly an immigrant, that they have this this attack mode against the very organization that provided them with a significant livelihood. The lack of gratitude for their success and what the PGA Tour has done for them is mind-boggling to me. And also, you know, they're taking money, they're taking blood money from a country that has no compulsion to kill people willy-nilly, their own citizens. They're against all sorts of social issues that that they'll kill people for.
Well, if you cheat on your husband, you have a good chance of getting stoned to death. Well, yeah, still do those.
I mean, it's absolutely backwards.
Well, it's barbaric.
But Mike,
The PGA Tour is known for its charity. They give away millions and millions and millions of dollars every year to charities. And these people are out there, you know, trying to bribe some of our best golfers, in which they have done. They've basically bribed them into coming to play the tour.
Well, maybe the Saudis will set up an Evan. Maybe the Saudis will set up an Evan scholarship program in Riyadh, and caddies can go over there and go to university. No, Greg Norman, yeah, you heard this, I'm sure, Mike, following this, as it sounds like you have been. Greg Norman responding to what you said about the Saudi, said, well, look at America. Look at the racism in America. It's terrible. comparing America to Saudi Arabia. That's what Greg Norman offered, and then all these players are going there for the cash.
Yeah, but, you know, it seems like the United States of America is moving forward with the issue of racism, while Saudi Arabia is stuck in the mud. They're among the most racist people that there are in the world.
And homophobic.
I mean, you name it. They're completely a country that has no business, trying to talk about morals.
And so, as a PGA professional, what do you want the PGA to do? Should they stick to their guns and say it's either you're with us or you're with the LIV Tour and you're not playing in tour-sanctioned events here, Phil or DJ or Bryson?
Well, you know, the thing that I think is being missed about the PGA Tour is that it's run by a 13-member policy board that are all PGA Tour members. These decisions are being made by the players, not by some random organization.
Yeah.
I think that the PGA Tour is doing what they think is right for them.
And what you see too, I mean, they had this moment when the Phil Mickelson stuff broke, where the commissioner went to the young guns, the Justin Thomases and Jordan Spieths of the world, and basically said, are you staying here or are you going there? And they all said, stay in there. And then there's, you know, some of the backstory, if you know the tour, where there's a lot of people on tour, a lot of the other players on tour don't hold Phil Mickelson in high regard.
They really don't. And, he has a great public face, but he, behind the scenes, he's a real mess. And I just don't think that losing Phil Mickelson or Dustin Johnson or anybody of that mindset, who really has no regard for the people that have brought them up in the profession of golf. I mean, they just have shown a complete contempt for an organization and a group of players that they have been members of. They have this contempt for them that is really kind of disappointing and very, very kind. I don't know. I just think that they're upside down with their thought process.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Mike. And
if you need money for your family and you might have some debts to pay off, if you know what I mean, $200 million, that's pretty good.
Yeah. I know it's tough when
you sell your soul to the devil.
Yeah, you get the first half a billion. It doesn't quite cut it for the family, Phil.
You think he might have a problem?
Well, it's interesting. No, now compare this to Tiger turning down $1 billion.
$1 billion.
Turning down $1 billion when, you know, he basically is not competitive anymore, and he's not going to be. Turns down $1 billion. I mean,
a lot about his character.
He has all the money in the world, but he also understands his brand and his and even if it's, you know, partly a commercial decision, it still shows a certain fealty to the PGA Tour, so that he is remembered in the pantheon of the greatest of the game, from Bobby Jones to Palmer and Nicklaus to himself. I mean, he's not
going to do anything to sully his reputation.
He's going to be remembered that way. I'm not sure Phil Mickelson will be after this. Big difference. You know, at a certain point for these guys, you know, you get beyond money and you think about posterity and legacy and.
Yeah, because he's going to be making money long after his golf career is over.
Matt, Old Irving Park.
Hey, how you doing this morning?
Good.
Love this topic. I absolutely love this topic because athletes for far too long, basketball, baseball, football, golf, I'm glad they're getting to be a part of it. Finally, stop with all the political nonsense and just tell everybody in the world, I'm out for the money.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for the call, Matt. Bob in West Chicago.
Yeah. My comment was, if a woke, feckless government that we have has no problem buying Saudi oil, and they're always mouthing off about human rights offenses, then what's the big deal with Phil taking the money? I mean, in my opinion, he's one of the best golfers, and that's never going to change. So whether he makes a business decision to take money from a competitor, that's isn't that the American way?
Well, nobody
and all these people who are so concerned about human rights violations, just look what our government's doing. I mean, my goodness, it's kind of a joke, the whole thing.
Thanks, Bob. Well, here's the thing. Nobody's prohibiting Phil from making this business decision. But just like we criticize the decisions or the conduct of our government, there's some people, myself included, criticizing the decision that was made by Phil Mickelson. So there actually is consistency there.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Professor Wilford McClay, who is now at Hillsdale College, wrote a book. We had him on when he wrote it, Land of Hope, which is essentially a history book for K through 12 that provides a contextual look at American history, starting from the premise that our founding principles were inspired. They should continue to inspire us. And despite the failings that are documented throughout American history and need to be discussed and understood, that America is a beacon of hope for the world over for a reason. He writes, have we become an unserious country? And he goes through a series of rhetorical questions. Would a serious country run up $30 trillion in debt? Would a serious country actively seek to demoralize its police force and undermine the authority of parents? Would a serious country allow the apparatus by which it elects its leaders to become so corrupted and to fall into such disrepair that its citizenry of both major parties no longer trust the outcomes of elections? But he goes on to ask, here's the question that most concerns me. Would a serious country so completely lose perspective on its own past that it would entertain the idea that the nation was founded on slavery rather than the ideals that have made it a beacon to the rest of the world? And would a serious country think it appropriate to teach children that the nation's past is best understood as a parade of horrors to which the most appropriate response is not pride, but lacerating shame? We need to become a serious country again. And to do that, we need to believe in ourselves, believe in the reason we have been placed here as a land of hope for a world that needs hope more than ever. We need to understand that a world without America will be immeasurably diminished, both in material and spiritual terms, and we have no choice but to live up to the responsibilities that come with our many blessings. Well, that is a great charge that he makes. Unfortunately, where do we find ourselves today? With a made-for-TV production about an invented insurrection juxtaposed against an actual attempt on the life of a sitting Supreme Court justice that was, dare I say, incited by the Senate Majority Leader, among others. The play, the attempted murder of Brett Kavanaugh by a 26-year-old Californian who had a suitcase, backpack, Glock 17 with two magazines and ammo, pepper spray, tactical knife, hammer, screwdriver, crowbar, zip ties, and duct tape.
Well, he's ready to go. And despite the fact that there was security in front of Brett Kavanaugh's house, the guy was so crazy and demented that he called 911 on himself to let him know what his intentions were.
Inspired by the prospect of Roe v. Wade being overturned and perhaps the words of the Senate Majority Leader, perhaps, I'll add more color to this in a moment, from March of 2020 to present, really.
And they're taking away fundamental rights. I want to tell you, Gorsuch, I want to tell you, Kavanaugh, you have released the whirlwind, and you will pay the price.
That's so sinister.
You won't know what hit you if you go forward with these awful decisions.
Now, you don't know. That sounds like a threat to me, Dan.
Now, I'm going to give Pagliacci the benefit of the doubt.
Why?
He's talking about that in a political sense. He's not talking about making a play to take the life of Brett Kavanaugh or Neil Gorsuch. I don't believe that. And the words of politicians are not the legally culpable when it comes to the actions of people like this guy outside Kavanaugh's house or the guy that shot up the softball game. Or, oh, by the way, President Trump, when he called on people to protest the election results on leading up to and on January 6th. So let's not fall into the trap of those who would ban political speech under the auspices of saving our democracy, because it does just the opposite. But in terms of the quality of the debate, in terms of the question Wilford McClay, Professor McClay, asks of, are we a serious nation? Boy, it's hard to answer in the affirmative at present, isn't it? For more on this, pleased to be joined by David Harsanyi, senior editor at The Federalist, thefederalist.com. David, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
What about your reaction to the news of this 26-year-old from California who had nefarious plans for Kavanaugh, and against the backdrop not just of 1-6 made for TV tonight, but also, of course, the debate going on about guns in America?
Well, I mean, obviously, the words you just played from Chuck Schumer were more insightful than anything President Trump said on January 6th. I mean, if Trump is responsible for that, they call it a riot, surely Schumer is responsible in some way. But I think it's much bigger than that, actually. I mean, you know, when you're constantly depicting your political opponents as, you know, insurrectionists, as terrorists, as child, you know, as people who abet child murder,
yeah,
people who want to tear down your country. I mean, if those things were true, violence would actually be okay, right? I mean, if people were really trying to do that to your country, you would have a right to fight back. Of course, it's just an insidious lie, always, basically. And but I think you're going to see, unfortunately, this happen maybe more often, and it's pretty, I think, scary prospect.
Well, I mean, just to put an exclamation point on your comments, this week we had Eric Swalwell, Mr. Honeypot there in California, who said to Republicans on his committee during a hearing, are you here to represent child killers? Or are you here to represent the children? You had, after the horrific school shooting in Uvalde, you had a popular podcaster named Ethan Klein say that the NRA convention that was being held the following weekend in Houston should be bombed. So, I mean, that, you know, that gets a little bit more specific to your point. And when we talk about these people who commit horrific crimes being radicalized online, living in isolation, being radicalized online by those who want to foment discord and violence, you know, what do we have from some members of the political class?
Right. To be fair, Swalwell has the IQ of a chinchilla. So
that is fair.
Takes him seriously.
Yeah,
but no, he's a terrible, terrible person. I mean, he smears half the country all the time as essentially, you know, being, you know, murderers and fascists and things like that. It's just, it's unconscionable. I don't, you know, 20 years ago, people wouldn't really, you'd have some quacks here and there, you know, but you wouldn't hear this kind of thing mainstreamed. And now, I think because people live in their bubbles and people, you know, are on social media, you know, this excites and gets you people, and it gets you followers, but it's really bad for the country.
Well, don't you think, I mean, should anything be done? I mean, both in the Buffalo shooter and the Uvalde, they both waited till they turned 18 and then they got to buy their AR-15s. I mean, you know, we used to drink here in Illinois at the age of 18. We used to drink in Wisconsin at the age of 18, and they eventually raised it to 21. Does that seem, you know, I mean, I hate to use the word, the C word compromise, but is there something that they could give? Or do you think that would then open the door and just dismantle the Second Amendment?
I mean, I think in a bigger deal on guns that focuses on mental health issues, on how we protect kids in schools and stuff like that, the fair thing to debate. I struggle with that question. I don't know. But here's the thing. I think if in a society we decide that 21 is the age when someone becomes an adult, then that's the age that it should be for all rights and all things. So, you know, you have Obamacare, you're adult till 26. You have voting, you're an adult at 18. Voting rights and the right to the Second Amendment, I think, should align with each other then, you know, things like that. Now, obviously, I realize it's very difficult and you'd have to change things in the Constitution, et cetera. But, you know, so that concerns me that there's this sort of Calvin ball that the Democrats play on when someone is a child and when they are an adult. So I am concerned about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is, by the way, the same party that wants to raise the age to 21 for certain weapons, wants to lower the age to vote to 16. So,
voting is supposed to be the most sacred thing we do on earth,
right?
It's like, but, you know, but yet, you know, you can, they want, you know, kids to do that who are actually kids, but then to defend, you know, there are many 18-year-olds who are actually quite responsible, you know, so also we send them to war, right? We put them in peril. And so I just think that's a bigger discussion.
Also, too, I mean, to wax philosophical for a moment, right? It would be a little bit more serious. I mean, I don't know if these arguments can be made in the context of our political discourse today, but it seems to me like the fundamental flaw in the premise of the left is that they think they can limit man's capacity for evil by limiting the number of rounds in a magazine.
Right. I mean, you could show up with, you know, a gun and a bunch of magazines, right? Is this, or, you know, this guy who showed that Kavanaugh's door did a lot of the, of these mass shootings, I still believe that the AR-15 is just used for aesthetic reasons and some sort of sick, demented cultural reason. I mean, I think the Virginia Tech shooter had, which was one of the worst mass murders, had handguns, right? So I think 9mm. So I think that, you know, or let me put it this way as well, most mass shooters, I think the average age of these mass shooters is like 33 or something like that in the country over the last 10 years. So I think they'll get there. I hate to make the argument that laws are broken and then that they don't matter or something, but to me it's clear that you can get yourself on, you know, your hands on weapons if you really want. And frankly, sadly, killing people is not as difficult to do as people think.
Hmm. How important in terms of not just what happens in November as foreshadowing, but also what happens in big city America was the recall of Chase Abodin in San Francisco on Tuesday.
Well, I think there are like two issues that you can't, that aren't ideological in a way, and that, you know, you can't sort of smear the other people, and that most voters don't really care about partisan politics. And one is crime and the other is inflation. These aren't things you can, and I don't, you know, we don't know, we can't quantify how much a certain politician is to blame, but you're going to take the blame. You're going to take the blame for inflation. You're going to take the blame for crime. And now, only 2 years ago, and even last year, you had people saying, you know, abolish the police. And Democrats were scared, you know, mainstream Democrats were scared to push back against that, even Joe Biden during the campaign. So now you have to pay a price for that. So I think you're going to see in the midterms a price paid for that in many districts, because you have, you know, you have Hispanic voters, you have Asian voters who live in urban areas who don't want to live in that sort of environment. And I think they're going to push back.
Can you explain to us Biden abuse of power and this energy crisis? I mean, he wants, he even said, you know, it's going to be rough, but the end game is, you know, not to be reliant on oil. And everybody has an electric car, but the average price of an electric car, if you can even get one, is $56,000.
Yeah. And that's already, you know, already heavily subsidized by taxpayers. You know, it would be more like $125,000 if it weren't. Well, I saw Jimmy Kimmel. He was on Jimmy Kimmel yesterday. Asked him, why don't you sign more executive orders? You know, Trump did it all the time. Biden has blown Trump out of the water with his executive orders. He is a completely abused executive power. And this latest thing, the Defense Production Act, it's meant to be used during wartime if there is a shortage of something that we actually need. We sort of need gas. I still don't think he has the right to use it for gas either. But what he's doing is he's helping America. It's cronyism. He's helping American companies make solar panels. Now, solar panels might be necessary, they might not, but they definitely are not bringing down the price of energy. I mean, these are the same people who said that the Canadian pipeline, you know, wouldn't do anything for, you know, gas and oil prices, but yet they're talking about basically redoing all of society, remaking every grid, retrofitting your house, and then using executive orders to try to sort of jumpstart that. So I think it's a clear abuse of power, and I wish someone would take it to court. I just don't. I forget what year it was. I think 52. Truman tried to take over the steel to help steel mills, you know. Make steel. I forgot what the case is, you know, and the Supreme Court said no. There's just no precedent for this kind of interference in private industry.
Well, and
the Defense Production Act for solar panels. Give me a break.
And Biden and that appearance with the Man Show guy, he said he repeated the 9,000 leases talking point and energy companies aren't producing. There was a good piece in the Journal addressing that by one energy industry exec and a policy wonk from a think tank, too, on why energy companies won't produce, why they're returning significant cash to shareholders and dividends and share repurchases, not increasing their investment in their capital investments in infrastructure. They write, if investors and producers are acting as though they don't hear the current administration's demands for more drilling now, it's in large part because they heard their condemnations for drilling in the past. And they're predicting that once this crisis subsides, the anti-drilling, anti-fossil fuel rhetoric will ratchet back up and the policies will follow. So they don't want to get caught over their skis with an administration that they can't bank on.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, you know, this is a fungible commodity. And when you have, you know, and policies baked into the price, what you're going to do in the future is baked into today's price in many ways. And what do they want to do? They want to transition away from fossil fuels on one hand. And on the other hand, they're begging people to drill more. I mean, it's schizophrenic and it doesn't make any sense. I mean, Biden's over begging OPEC to drill. He's begging Venezuela to drill. But then over here, he wants us to make more solar panels. It makes no sense. The guy is, you know, bogged down by stupid ideology around him because I don't think, you know, he's making these decisions, frankly, but it is just disastrous.
He is David Harsanyi, senior editor at The Federalist, thefederalist.com. David, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Pedro Gonzalez writing over at Chronicles magazine. It's the culture stupid. And he takes out after a lot of those erstwhile conservatives at National Review for being critical of Ron DeSantis moving on Disney the way that he did, Ron DeSantis and Florida legislative Republicans, to remove their special tax treatment with that Disney Reedy Creek fiefdom that they had. There's no need for the Republican Party to salt the earth here, wrote Charles Cook. Pedro Gonzalez takes a different view. There is nothing principled about allowing one's country to be plowed under by the crazies or about standing idly by while a media conglomerate like Disney attempts to cow a state legislature. A newly assertive and populist conservative movement willing to fight the left and the corporate world will likely push establishment conservatives at National Review even further into cognitive dissonance. But the principle that will inform middle America's actions in the future won't be civility, but rather rewarding friends and punishing enemies. And he cites Florida as an example of doing just that. So, what kind of center-right movement do you want in this country to beat back the new Marxists? This is sort of the topic of Peter Berkowitz's latest piece, where he offers assessment of both the woke left and the new right. I think Pedro Gonzalez would be a good example of the new right of which he speaks. Peter Berkowitz, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, former director of policy planning at the State Department, joins us now. Peter, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
It's good to be with you. Thanks.
So I'm not sure I'm fully on board with your characterization of the new right. So why don't you give us your distillation of the woke left and the new right and the problems posed by each?
Sure. Happy to do so. So we're familiar, of course, with the woke left. They've been around for a long time. Woke is a new way to capture them. They attack. You could call it classical liberalism. You could call it the underpinning. The American constitutional order these days, Their leading complaints are one about the economy, that the basic principles of American constitutionalism have created these terrible inequalities in the United States, and second, have been responsible for promoting racism and sexism. And the problem is with the principles. A movement has grown up, as you know, among conservatives. And my most recent piece, I actually concentrate on the intellectuals, not Trump voters. And I want to make a distinction there. But the intellectuals actually share a disdain for what they call classical liberalism, the modern tradition of freedom. That's problematic from my point of view because to a very significant extent, the United States of America is founded on principles of freedom. But I distinguish the discontents of the new right intellectuals from the discontents of Trump voters. The discontents of Trump voters have to do with elites in Washington, but also in the corporate world, who pursue goals that are out of touch with the people's interests. And so on the debate between Charles Cook Pedro Gonzalez, I find myself closer to Gonzalez. I see no reason consistent with the principles of American constitutional government why the governor of a state can't decide that special exemptions legislated for a particular corporation are no longer in the state's interest. That's perfectly, as I understand it, perfectly consistent with the democratic choices of people and their duly elected governor.
You write about these new right intellectuals, again, to be specific. The new right champions the traditional virtues, but like the woke left, in the name of their respective priorities, both want government to implement happiness as they see it. Well, how does the new right intellectual set want government to institute happiness consistent with the traditional virtues?
Yes. So okay, happy to name names. Hiram Kozony has just come out with a book called Conservatism: A Rediscovery. One can learn a lot from this book, but at the center of it is a call for the federal government to strongly uphold and institutionalize Christianity, as I understand it, to teach Christianity in our schools as the truth of the matter. Now, there's a long tradition in the United States of America, led by serious Christians, that believes that the federal government is actually not competent be a teacher of religion, and great harm would be done to religion by having the federal government back it in this way. By the way, there's a distinction between what I'm concerned about here and some forms of prayer in school, as long as they're not coercive and involve choice. Another important thing from the new right is a man named Adrian Vermeule, a professor of law at Harvard Law School, who believes that has written a book called Common Good Constitutionalism, mm-hmm. and who also believes that it's the job of legislatures and judges in the matter of hard cases and of officials in the administrative state to make hard decisions based upon, as I understand it, what advances human flourishing and salvation of American citizens. I'm very skeptical about the ability of our government officials actually to do a lot of things, not least guide American citizens to salvation. And I really do want to underscore that my reservations come not from skepticism about the claims of religious faith, but from I think it's consistent with the American founding and the Tocquevillian view that out of respect for religion and out of respect for what religion does for the human soul, we want to separate religion and decline to give government officials responsibility for upholding it.
It seems to me it's sort of, and I agree with everything that you've said. It seems to me that this goes back to, if you don't trust these institutions and you believe the federal government has too much power, then if you're put in charge of it, don't reestablish your faith in it. Devolve power away from the federal government, which was your inclination when you were out of power, and dilute its power. Don't look at the federal government in particular as a and government in general as a force for good. It's the you know, the fearful master sort of argument.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, it's a terrible irony that conservatives who are the great critics of abuses of government power, great observers of the unintended consequences of legislation flowing from Washington, D.C., supposedly covering the whole 50 United States. Now, they're mad. I understand the anger. But the response is not great. Let us get power and let us use federal government to accomplish our highest goals. As you say, I think a commitment to conservative principles of limited government is not a way of neglecting ordinary voters' concerns. It's a way of actually responding to those concerns. And by the way, we have to emphasize, you can be opposed to the use of federal government to institutionalize Christianity as the nation's national religion and still in favor of government coming to the aid of middle-class workers whose manufacturing jobs have fled the country. There are places for government to be involved in our lives to advance the interests of ordinary voters that are still consistent with our traditional principles of limited government.
Yeah, I think, you know, and I think so much of the frustration from both the intellectual set, even where there are disagreements on the right, and including where that's largely aligned, including just your sort of rank and file Trump voter, is just the rule of law being undermined at every turn. VDH has a good piece on this called The Sovietization of American Life, in which he writes this, and I want to get your reaction to it. The law is no longer blind and disinterested, but adjudicates indictment, prosecution, verdict, and punishment on the ideology of the accused. Eric Holder is held in contempt of Congress and smiles. Peter Navarro is held in contempt of Congress and hauled off in cuffs and leg irons. Clapper and Brennan lied under oath to Congress and were rewarded with TV contracts. Roger Stone did the same, and a SWAT team showed up at his home. And he goes on, and you get the point. And the point is not only the arbitrary and capriciousness of law enforcement, but also that when the left is in power, they practice law enforcement in one respect. And when conservatives are in power, it's something very different. And there needs to be some equalizing of the rule of law, regardless of the party or philosophy in power.
Well, I believe that my colleague, Victor Davis Hanson, is quite correct in the sad situation that he so brilliantly describes. I think that many voters have seen that you don't really have the rule of law when you don't have equal justice, when the FBI and the Department of Justice are weaponized by one side. By the way, it's another reason not to trust the federal bureaucracy.
Exactly.
With large questions, promotion of religion. By the way, I say that for the sake of protecting religion in this country. I want the federal government to have less role in it, not more. But I think Victor has put his finger on a terrible problem with federal bureaucracies. I think if conservatives should focus on restoring the rule of law, because a rule of law for half the country is not rule of law, of course. And this takes us to also the problem of education. And alas, our schools and our colleges are not teaching our students the meaning of rule of law, the meaning of due process, the meaning of federal bureaucracies that stand above the fray and adjudicate controversies consistent with the Constitution and the federal code, as opposed to promoting their partisan political choices. So yes, I agree entirely with Victor that this is a huge problem for the United States of America.
He is Peter Berkowitz, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and former director of policy planning at the State Department. Peter, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Our next guest, Julie Kelly from American Greatness. AmGreatness.com has a good piece on what has not been and will not be covered by this 1-6 star chamber, including in their primetime special tonight, part of a limited series that should be streaming on Netflix between now and September when they release their report. But among the things that she doesn't cover and what will not be covered, the predicate for all of this, the predicate for the rally that was held outside the Capitol that unfortunately turned violent on January 6th, the belief that there was a bit of a rigging that went on in the 2020 election. So what about that? When yesterday, former Congressman Michael Ozzie Myers pled guilty, to election fraud, admitting to interfering on behalf of Pennsylvania Democratic candidates in the state's elections between 2014 and 2018. Pled guilty to conspiracy to deprive voters of civil rights, bribery, obstruction of justice, falsification of voting records, and conspiring to illegally vote in a federal election. That's the Department of Justice. That's a former congressman pleading guilty. Now, I know you say, well, Dan, that was 2014 to 2018, not 2020. Well, right. It's sort of like in Cook County, you know, if it happened once, it's likely that it's either happening or there's still vulnerabilities for it to happen. You know, prior instances of voter fraud should lead to heightened scrutiny of the operation and management of elections. Is that a fair statement? I think it is. Also, this story just out. Good piece of Real Clear Investigations by Mark Hemingway. He's a pretty damn good investigative reporter. He cites a report that was done by the Caesar Rodney Election Research Institute and a gentleman named Alex Oliver, chief data scientist. The report looked at the Zuckerbucks, all the $330 million plus of Zuckerberg grants to local election authorities around the country. And while they sprinkled the infield in some red jurisdictions, some jurisdictions that went for Trump, they did it cagily. Smaller grants. In fact, the grants to red jurisdictions comprised 27% of the Zucker grant awards. The largest 50 grants in terms of per capita spending, the average partisan lean in favor of Biden over Trump was 33 points, meaning the aid, as Mark Hemingway reports, I'm reading from his report, meaning the aid could be expected to stimulate more Democratic voters. 25 of the top 50 grants per capita went to just five states, Georgia, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Florida, and Texas, the latter two where Democrats were optimistic about Biden's chances, according to the authors of the study, even though, of course, he didn't win. But Georgia, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, seven of the top 10 largest grants per capita went to counties in Georgia and Wisconsin,
of course they did,
states that went to Biden by 12 and 21,000 votes, respectively. So, you know, the charge that was leveled during that election, subsequent to that election on January 6th, maybe that should be part of the examination, too, when it comes to the administration of elections, since Democrat socialists are so concerned about state election laws. And you would think that Republicans, good Republicans who believe in ballot integrity and the and free and fair elections, would raise these issues too, but I don't
think Adam Kinzinger or Liz Cheney are going to do that. I mean, there's Democrats, and those are the two Republicans that are on the committee, so it's a sham.
I don't think so, and I don't think their Hollywood stunt doubles, Claire Danes and Peter Dinklage, will either. And I think we've slated Mandy Patinkin to play the role of Jamie Raskin for tonight's special.
And we've, I just was racking my brain and asking, when was the last time we had a committee hearing that was moved to prime time? Because I think the Brett Kavanaugh hearing should have been moved to prime time, because that was insightful. That was something we learned, and it was a wonderful way that he defended himself against that lunatic. But this, I mean, I just think this is a way to bar Trump from running in 2024.
For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined by the aforesaid Julie Kelly, senior contributor for American Greatness, author of the book January 6th, How Democrats Used the Capitol Protest to Launch a War on Terror Against the Political Right. Julie, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Thanks for having me on.
This piece from Woodward and Bernstein, speaking of primetime hearings, published in the Amazon Post. As of this writing, the committee has an abundance of evidence that the insurrection was a Trump operation, and committee members have vowed to push further. Liz Cheney was asked about this by CBS reporter Robert Costa. She said she does believe it's a conspiracy. It's extremely broad. It is extremely well organized. It's really chilling. Is there any evidence that you've seen to substantiate those claims made by Woodward, Bernstein, or Cheney?
I actually have seen extensive evidence of it, but not the conspiracy that Liz Cheney is talking about. The interests behind the scenes, the same Democratic Party interests who brought us Russiagate, who brought us the whistleblower impeachment, operated for weeks, if not months, in advance of January 6th to provoke what happened that day. And I explain that in my book. So there definitely was a conspiracy, same conspiracy, by the way, that hijacked the 2020 election. These are all the same players. You see this playing out tonight, right, Dan and Amy? You have, Adam Schiff, Russiagate, hoaxer, impeachment, led the first impeachment. You have him on the committee. You have Democrats going to the network demanding that they air this on primetime, which, of course, they are. And so you've got the same sort of interest, Democratic Party interest, working with Congress, working with the media to once again try to convince the American people to believe something that is not true. There was no conspiracy with Donald Trump and what they're going to show tonight, the Proud Boys, about 15 of them who have been charged. None of them face weapons violations. Odd that these militia men brought no weapons to the Capitol that day. Didn't assault police officers, didn't vandalize any property. But yet, you just had this leak, the D.C. U.S. Attorney, oddly, the day after Liz Cheney made that claim, D.C. U.S. Attorney, this is how closely these same interests are working with the Department of Justice, just like Russiagate. D.C. U.S. Attorney announces seditious conspiracy charges against five Proud Boys. Now, this is a charge so rare, no American has ever been convicted of it. So this is all timed to create some kind of drama and compel people to watch what's happening tonight. Department of Justice, media, Democrats working together to defraud the American people once again, related to a sabotage campaign against Donald Trump.
And again, Dan thinks I'm, crazy that I'm actually shocked that ABC, NBC, CBS, I thought it was just the cable networks. Oh, no, they're all in on this. And during this highly choreographed hearing, which they are going to use footage for, never seen before, they're teasing it now, as you know, from the documentarian from the Proud Boys, they're also going to be putting interviews, witness interviews, because they have 1,000 of them, and they're going to highlight certain people that they've, interviewed during this 10-month investigation. And who are they choosing? Trump's children. And they're going to cherry-pick that, so it's not going to be set in context.
That's right, Amy. I think the American people would rather see if the committee actually interviewed FBI Director Christopher Wray. Did they even interview him? Will we see clips of that interview? Will we see interviews with Nancy Pelosi's office and Mitch McConnell's office, the two offices primarily responsible with the Capitol Police Board of securing the Capitol grounds that day, which they did not? What about an interview with D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser, also responsible for securing Capitol grounds that day? Why didn't they? Why did she reject offers of at least 10,000 guardsmen that day and only deployed 317 of them, even though more than 1,000 were at the armory starting at 6 o'clock that morning? Those are the interviews they probably didn't even conduct. let alone that they will allow the American people to see.
Well, something else, too. You have these Proud Boys indicted for sedition. And
most people don't even know what that means.
And this was after a couple of months ago, the FBI announced there was no evidence of any coordinated conspiracy. So what happened between the FBI's proclamation and the news this week of those indictments?
Nothing. And in fact, I compared the new indictment that was handed down on Monday with the first set of indictments against the Proud Boys, which was March of 2021. There's basically no new information in this indictment. These men were charged with conspiracy. By the way, five of them have been incarcerated since last March. Wow. Under pretrial detention orders, part of the political prisoners held under the Biden regime. There's no new information in there. This is all coordinated by the D.C. U.S. Attorney Matthew Graves, who is a Biden campaign advisor, whose wife is a radical activist in Washington, D.C., heads up a women's legal fund that was behind all sorts of left-wing policies, left-wing agenda. So this is what he is doing, working hand-in-hand with Pelosi and Adam Schiff, to produce these ridiculous charges, destroy these men's lives, and try to bolster what Liz Cheney said. This was some massive, chilling conspiracy when no such thing exists.
Oh, by the way, we have to cast Adam Schiff. I forgot we didn't cast him. I will suggest the skeleton from Creepshow will play the role of Adam Schiff on this made-for-TV special, produced by none other than James Goldstein, the former head of ABC News. So I guess Steven Spielberg was unavailable, but they got somebody who's very talented at storytelling. So that should be something that's very compelling. In your piece on what the committee will not cover, Julie, you also make the point, since they run around talking about saving our democracy and we have to be transparent and comprehensive, well, there's all sorts of evidence that could be made available to the public about what happened on that day that isn't being made available to the public, like the surveillance video inside and outside the Capitol. And, you know, that leads one to be a little bit suspicious, or should lead one to be a little bit suspicious about those announcements about saving our democracy and being transparent and comprehensive and fact focused. Right.
Right. Yeah. So if we were really going to be transparent, then the government would release the 14,000 hours of surveillance video captured by security cameras that day. They would release all the communications from Capitol Police responsible for the security of that Capitol. Capitol Police continue to fight lawsuits to get that video and all of their records related to January 6th, claiming sovereign immunity. Also, Nancy Pelosi's office is completely off limits, as Benny Thompson, the chairman of the committee, said. We won't see any correspondence between her office, U.S. Capitol Police, the FBI, et cetera, related to January 6th. Speaking of the FBI, as I just said, we won't hear from Christopher Wray. Where are all the documents and records discussing the undercover agents and informants who were involved in January 6th months before? The New York Times recorded last year that at least two informants were with these Proud Boys, by the way, on January 6th and were among the first to breach an exterior perimeter. Will we hear about that during the Proud Boys presentation tonight, who those informants were, who directed them, how long they had infiltrated the group? I highly doubt it.
Was Ray Epps an informant?
To answer, I'm sorry, Amy.
Oh, was Ray Epps an informant?
Well, that's a great point, Amy. We still don't know who Ray Epps is. We know he spoke to the committee. We know that Adam Kinzinger, who calls everyone involved in January 6th an insurrectionist, but somehow, you know, came to the defense of Ray Epps. We still don't know who that man is who on January 5th and 6th encouraged people to go inside the Capitol. He was actually the last man to whisper in the ear of Ryan Samso, who breached the exterior perimeter with members of the Proud Boys. But somehow, and you will see tonight, selective clips that exclude Ray Epps from that first breach. You will see how they will selectively edit that. You will not see a tall man in a camouflage, in a taupe jacket with a red hat on. He will be outside of the view of whatever clips they bring tonight. Raising more questions about who he is and why we still don't know why he remains uncharged and was removed from the FBI's most wanted list when people started asking questions why he had not been charged yet.
I'm looking at his picture now on Google's image. So,
and we also won't know because Christopher Wray, Merrick Garland won't tell us if and how many FBI assets were present on January 6th, whether agents or informants, right?
We will not. We cannot get an answer. Ted Cruz couldn't even get an answer from Jill Sanborn, one of the top FBI officials, during a hearing earlier this year,
right,
when he asked her twice whether informants or agents either provoked or were engaged in violent conduct that day. She would not answer the question.
Oh, well, that answers the question.
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah.
Julie Kelly, senior contributor for American Greatness, amgreatness.com, author of January 6th, How Democrats Used the Capitol Protest to Launch a War on Terror Against the Political Right. Julie, thanks for joining us. Enjoy the show tonight.
I will. You guys too. Thanks.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
They got the beat, the campus beat, the campus beat. Yeah, the campus beat.
Yeah, Dan and Amy, and the big guy was on with that that guy who used to host Win Ben Stein's Money. Apparently he's got a late night talk show. And talking about a lot of things, including why he's optimistic about the future. The big guy's optimistic about the future of this country, despite the challenges, including all of them imposed by this administration. Here's why.
The ability of that party to, that minority of the MAGA folks.
It's like we're living in two countries at once.
Yeah, and
it's
so,
like you
but,
can be, you can
but I've
be.
I've never been more optimistic in my life, though. Tell you why.
Why are you so optimistic?
No,
it makes no sense.
No, it does. Look at the kids.
Blah, 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 blah.
Look at the young. Best educated, least prejudiced, most giving generation in American history. Turn on the television.
Yeah.
Turn on it. No, I'm serious.
Yeah. Oh, serious. Yeah.
No,
yeah,
but I'm
yeah,
serious. Yeah. You turn on the TV, look at the ads. When's the last time you saw biracial couples on TV? When's the last time you saw the way, I mean, people
They're
are selling products.
Couples.
They do ads to sell products. And they sell products when people, they appeal to people. This generation is going to change everything. We just got to make sure we don't give up.
Yeah,
there's biracial couples everywhere.
I know. That's what I'm saying. I'm sanguine for the future of America because there are biracial couples in advertisements for consumer products. Yeah, that is an exciting development.
Wow.
On the flip side, I'd like to enter some anecdotal evidence as well as statistical evidence that there's no reason to be optimistic. I mean, I'm all for, you know, beautiful couples that span the rainbow in your commercials for consumer products and the like. I don't think that's a leading indicator of how healthy we are as a nation, though. Sorry.
312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line. Lines are open. You can also text us at 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Syracuse University, they had a little rally for abortion. Because that's what you do on college campuses these days. And this was organized by the Party for Socialism and Liberation, as well as, of course, the Democrat Socialists of America, the chapter there at Syracuse. Are they still called the Orange Men?
Yes, they are.
Party for Socialism and Liberation. Here's one of their leading thinkers explaining, you know, what's going on, not just with the promotion of abortion, but the need for revolution to overthrow the, you know, to overthrow our capitalist system, to break free from the chains. Take a listen to the best and the brightest, the reason for optimism in this country, Syracuse.
Will there be some blood tests, sir?
Abortion is a human right!
Come on, join the fight!
Abortion is a human right!
Come on, join the fight!
The draft opinion was leaked seeking to overturn Roe v. Wade. We're not okay with that. Fully
in support of a socialist society. We do not agree with the fact that 9 unelected Supreme Court judges decide our future.
They don't care if women die. Pro-life is a lie. They don't care if women die. Pro-life is a lie.
We are a Marxist-Leninist organization. We do believe in class war. We believe the class war is the path forward. As we see right now, peaceful protests aren't, getting us much. We can't vote our way out of this. We need a new society. And in order to do that, there probably will be some issues.
We won't give up without a fight. My body, my rights. We won't give up without a fight. My body, my rights.
I think we could spend centuries trying to vote our way out of capitalism, and I firmly believe that we need a social society. In order to do that, we need a revolution. Will there be some bloodshed? Certainly.
Will there be some bloodshed? Certainly. You know, there's going to be some bloodshed when you want to transform the society from capitalist to socialist. Can't vote your way out of it. So, you know, going to break a few eggs. And they're serious about it. And we've seen this playing out. It's not been reported very much, except perhaps on a few media outlets like ours. Pro-life medical office and pregnancy center in Buffalo firebombed on Tuesday morning by pro-abortion radicals. Compass Care, Christ-centered organization. It's a, crisis pregnancy center. Sustained heavy damage to the building. The abortion terrorist group's Jane's Revenge took credit for the attack, spray painting their signature Jane Was Here on the side of the structure.
Well, that's good. That helps authorities.
Washington, D.C. Crisis Pregnancy Center vandalized with red paint splashed across the center's door. Jane Says Revenge, spray painted on the building. Of course, we talked about Wisconsin Family Action. They had a Molotov cocktail or cocktails thrown into their office. With graffiti in their office, if abortions aren't safe, then you aren't either. And we played voicemails from various people calling the Wisconsin Family Action office and making all sorts of depraved threats and disgusting comments in the direction of people who operate Wisconsin Family Action. So, you know, when they say, it's going to be a little... Oh, bloodshed, certainly. You can't get anything done without cracking a few heads, knocking a few people out, blowing up a few pro-life crisis pregnancy centers. I remember...
No, knocking out some eyeballs. Remember when the police officer in Chicago got his eyeball knocked out at, outside the Columbus statue of Melee?
Yeah, I remember when you had people attacking the instances where you've had, like, an Eric Rudolph, where they've attacked... an abortion mill. I remember the pro-life response, including mine, which is that violence has no place in America generally, and including in this issue. It's no justification. What they're doing inside that mill is not a justification to commit an act of violence to prevent violence. I don't hear the same denunciations with respect to these attacks on pro-life organizations and crisis pregnancy centers around the country being celebrated on college campuses like at Syracuse, while they suggest that what is happening is what needs to happen because you can't vote your way out of it, and they're justifying it. Don't see much coverage of it, and don't see much denunciation of the violence. Again, it's sort of like what we talked about earlier with respect to mass shootings, with respect to Pagliotti's rhetoric in the direction of Kavanaugh and the threat that was made on Justice Kavanaugh's life yesterday. They sort of need it. They sort of need that violence as the predicate for, just as that young woman at Syracuse said, overthrowing. They have nothing to lose but their chains. And those workers of the world are attempting to unite, aren't they? Also, if we could continue on the topic of how optimistic we should be about the young people in this nation who are so bright and so tolerant. Well, first of all, we have a Department of Education study that we mentioned on this show a couple of weeks ago. Department of Education study that looked at grades, this generation of students versus the grades from a couple generations previous. And once you started controlling for coursework, what looked to be better grades and better scores evaporated. It turns out that this generation of students knows a lot less than the generation of students that I'm a part of, which probably on average knew a lot less than the generation of students that were a couple of generations before me. Because that's been the slide of American education. And so there was this interesting thread on Reddit. anyone high school teachers here dealing with the constant thought of how the frack did you pass elementary school as it relates to their students? This teacher who posted this and then got all these comments, like thousands. My students don't know how to find the area of a square. They're in high school. Any high school here teachers here dealing with the constant thought of how the frack did you pass elementary school? Any high school teachers out there dealing with the same thing? Some other comments from high school teachers. We're raising a generation of functional illiterates, and functional is debatable. One of my high school classes admitted that none of them had read a single book since elementary school. In wow. literature classes, the book is read aloud or they just watch the movie. Last week, I asked what 1 times 1 was to a class of 9th graders. You can guess what happened. Can I use a calculator? Question mark. 2. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Some of the responses, of course. Senior ELA teacher here. I stopped even asking them to identify nouns and verbs because how few can terrifies me. I had a senior last year who did not know the months of the year.
Oh, my God.
Only that we were in his birth month and he knew which month came after. Another, since I teach a college prep ELA, English language arts class, to seniors, and the amount of spelling, grammar, and formatting errors are just depressing at this point. Some of them struggle to write a complete sentence, and I have had to have several conversations with them as to why it is not okay to copy and paste from the internet and turn it in as their essay. You know, Condi Rice spoke here at Judson College. This has got to be 5 or 6 years ago now. This is after she had returned to Stanford and she was teaching international relations courses and so forth. And she said at her speech, Stanford, that her undergrads, you know, the undergrads in her class, Stanford undergrads in her classes at Stanford. This is reputedly one of the top schools in the country, right? She says, you cannot believe how few people can write a term paper, how they can set forward a thesis statement, provide the evidence, address counterarguments, present a conclusion. You'd be surprised how few of my students at Stanford can offer something coherent in that format. So tell me again how we're this generation or the young people today are being afforded such wonderful opportunities to advance the course of human knowledge and provide so much reason for optimism. I don't want to be cynical about it, but I want to be realistic. And I don't want to give in to politicians' happy talk, and neither should you. Just remarkable. One bright spot, Title IX at the collegiate level. The only problem with this bright spot is, as we have been talking about, most colleges are so far gone that you're just sort of picking over the rubble, the intellectual rubble now. I don't know what it means. Before we get to that, Mike in Melrose Park.
Hey, good morning, guys. Hey, I just recently met at a party a 7th grader, a daughter of some of my friends. She could not add 25 and 12 in her head. She had to have a piece of paper to do it, and then her parents made excuses for it. And she just giggled the whole time, like, I don't know.
Did she have special needs?
And I thought, no, just ordinary kid.
Uh-huh.
But that just goes to what you're saying.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Mike. On Title IX, there's a case, a sexual harassment claim that was made against a Cornell assistant physics professor that is of the character assassination variety. He has made a Title IX claim against the school for gender discrimination. The second U.S. Court of Appeals resuscitated his claim after it was dismissed at the district court level. But it's this comment from Judge Jose Caprenas that I think is the silver lining here, but it may be, you know, alas, too late to do much good at the collegiate level, maybe even the K through 12 level. He writes, in concurrence of the opinion reviving the claim of the Cornell professor, I pause briefly to comment in my own name that, as alleged, this case describes deeply troubling aspects of contemporary university procedures to adjudicate complaints under Title IX and other closely related statutes. In many instances, these procedures signal a retreat from the foundational principle of due process, the erosion of which has been accompanied by a decline in modern universities' protection of the open inquiry and academic freedom that has accounted for the vitality and success of American higher education. And he goes on from there. But his point is to say, you know, these legal norms we have are also cultural norms, and the universities forgot that. Well, the ideologues in control of them purposely discarded them, maybe is even more accurate. And the colleges and universities in America have been degraded as a result. The same thing goes with K-12. So the only problem is, with this silver lining, is that most of the kids in college, much less at K-12, don't understand a word of what I just read.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.